Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The summer of 68, this hour of the show, the season that changed baseball and America forever.
I'm sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same.
That song was topping the Billboard charts back in 1968. On this day, April 4, 1968, the horrors of the summer of 1968 began with the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Later in the hour, we'll hear Robert Kennedy's comments to the people in Central City, Indianapolis, which move me. I listen to them every year, and they are incredibly moving. For those of you who were alive at that time, you'll remember how difficult the summer of 68 was. Baseball was, of course, still played, but baseball and politics are intertwined, and you couldn't escape on the ballpark, although maybe some players tried to do that. What was happening politically, if you were playing baseball or if you were working, whatever you were doing, going to school, it really rocked the country. Our guest this hour is the author of the aforementioned book, Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball in America Forever, Tim Wendel. Tim is the author of 9 books, including High Heat, Far From Home, Red Rain, and Castro's Curveball. He's a founding editor of USA Today Baseball Weekly. He's written for Esquire, GQ, Washingtonian Magazine. He teaches writing at Johns Hopkins University and has appeared on CNN, ESPN, Sirius Radio, NPR, recently served as an exhibit advisor to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah. I am so sobered that we're talking to you 44 years after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. This was one of those days that was really, really, really hard in this country.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's, you know, one of the things I tried to do in summer of 68 was, you know, how tumultuous the year was, but then what people did to, in a sense, get through. And it's, again, maybe a little ironic we're talking on the anniversary of King's death, because one of the points I make in the book, and actually we just ended up putting up some an essay about it on American Scholar on their website, that in my mind, two of the best speeches ever given in this country were given on consecutive days, right about this time, 44 years ago. One was April 3rd with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Speech to
yes.
the mountaintop.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the aforementioned one, Bobby Kennedy speaking to the crowd in Indianapolis. And what I find striking about both of them, especially with today's political climate, is that both of them were given from few, if any, notes. If anything, both main players, King and Kennedy, almost disregarded what their handlers were saying. We didn't have teleprompters. We didn't have focus groups. And in both of those speeches, kind of got off a little bit to a rough start, but then both individuals really spoke from the heart. And I think that's what audiences really wanted to hear. And you look back at those speeches, the mountaintop speech and then the Kennedy's Indianapolis speech, I mean, their words still ring true today. And I think it's sometimes we forget how soothing or how healing words can be, but I think they really need to be, in a sense, from the heart and speaking to the moment, as opposed to being, you know, analyzed and mixed and matched to somehow, you know, play off what we're supposed to be wanting or feeling.
Yeah. Now, simultaneously, you have the world of sports, and it reeled from what happened today, and it reeled from what happened a few weeks hence when Bobby Kennedy was also assassinated. This was the time when the boys of summer were about to return. Baseball was still America's favorite sport. It was about to change to football. Tell me how baseball responded. Were they still in spring training camps 44 years ago today?
They were just about ready to start the regular season, Kathleen, and the start of the season was delayed several days because of King's assassination, the funeral, some days of mourning, etc. And one of the things I've tried to do in the summer of 68, there's been a great deal written, as you well know, about that year. I mean, we look at it politically, we look at it culturally, musically. I mean, this is, you know, you were playing Otis Redding there earlier. This is also the time where the Beatles start to break up. We're in between the Summer of Love and then Woodstock's on the horizon, etc. What I've tried to do in this work is bring sports to the forefront to some degree. I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about, the King, Kennedy assassination, Chicago riots, they're in the summer of 68, but they're more of a backdrop. And what I was intrigued by was how top athletes from those days, the backbone of the book is baseball, but we also take a look at the Olympics, football. When you put it up in the forefront, they were as impacted by, you know, everyday citizens, by what was going on. And I was really intrigued by how some of the major individuals I focus upon coped, what they did to get through. And I think in some ways, the fact that the St. Louis Cardinals, Detroit Tigers, the two teams that meet in the World Series that year, arguably were among some of the most integrated institutions in the country at that point in time. And so we have this irony a little bit that fans during that time period, you know, if their communities were splitting up and they're seeing upheaval all around them, they could still go to the ballpark and see, in the case of the St. Louis Cardinals, blacks, whites, Latinos in the same uniform and striving to try to do something together. And in my mind, sports, at least in some small way, held the country together in 68.
And you, at some point in the book, talk about Dr. Martin Luther King and Bob Gibson from the Cardinals passing at the airport in Atlanta, and talk about King being fully aware of the importance of sports in the whole movement for racial equality, and his acknowledging in a silent way Bob Gibson, but he surely must have known about him.
Oh, he certainly did. And that's, it's funny, that's one of the scenes that, you know, I think anytime you're doing a book, you hear about things and you go, it'd be great if we could nail that down.
Right.
And it happened. A few weeks into the year 1968 in the old Atlanta airport, Bob Gibson, then the staff ace, African-American, prominent African-American athlete, passed Dr. Martin Luther King in the airport. And they nodded at each other. And one thing I wanted to tease out once I had that confirmed is, if they had stopped and talked, what would they have said? And I found it intriguing because I ended up going back to Memphis and talked to a great many people that were part of King's, like, inner cadre at that point, most specifically a gentleman named Reverend Billy Kiles, who still runs, is still the pastor for the Monumental Baptist Church in South Memphis. And Reverend Kiles isn't that much of a sports fan, but he confirmed to me that King was, and he certainly, and King knew who Gibson was. And then we had, actually were able to have almost a little bit of this hypothetical kind of conversation. If they had stopped, what would have King told Gibson? And in a sense, Kiles believes King would have said, you know, in essence, keep up the good work. We're watching you. You're the staff ace of a prominent team, a world championship team. And it was interesting to then kind of take those comments and, in a sense, give them back to Gibson through his people, because Gibson was not, he was a very, I'm looking for the right word, let's just say very wound tight individual, and passive aggressive, you know, passive resistance was not his deal. And so, and at times I know Gibson felt that maybe he should have been more in, like, in the King way of doing things, but in a sense, hearing back from King's people that no, you know, they were proud of him for what he was doing. in doing it his way, I think in a lot of ways felt kind of reassuring, even now, to Gibson.
And for those who aren't very familiar with Bob Gibson, tell me more about his background and about his the way he handled himself, because he was kind of inscrutable. He didn't seem to be a very, this is an understatement, welcoming, friendly kind of guy, right? He just wasn't.
I think maybe intimidating is right. Maybe more that way. He was a gentleman, an athlete, who really fought his way up to the top. I think that's maybe the best way to sum it up. And everywhere he turned, you know, growing up, late 50s into the 60s, you know, it was met by a lot of closed doors. Arguably basketball was his best sport, but there really wasn't much room for him, either at the collegiate level. He actually showed some interest at one point in playing for Indiana University when he was in high school, and pretty much got the response from Indiana, no, we've already got our one black player. We don't need any more. And actually played with the Harlem Globetrotters for a little bit, but didn't like the joking and, you know, in a sense what the Globetrotters are about, even though he really admired them as athletes. So he turned to baseball and was a very aggressive player. And I think one of the things I find striking about the summer of 68, Kathleen, is just how you have somebody like Gibson who's wound this tight, and in a sense his response to both the King and the Kennedy assassinations. Gibson's roommate was Kurt Flood, who was very close to Dr. Martin Luther King, actually attended some of the rallies that King had done in previous years. And so when King's assassinated, Gibson was, as he says, jolted by it. He did not get off to maybe the best of starts in the 68 season. The big name, the headlines were being made by Don Drysdale, for example, with his scoreless streak with the L.A. Dodgers, which ironically is the first thing that Bobby Kennedy mentions in his last speech at the Ambassador Hotel. And, you know, and Catfish Hunter is pitching a perfect game for then the new team in Oakland. And it's not till Kennedy's assassination that something changes or clicks for Gibson. And Gibson has this comment that, yes, I was jolted when they killed King, but when they killed Bobby Kennedy, I became infuriated. And somehow he was able to channel this anger, this passion, into one of the most epic seasons of all time. He doesn't pitch his first shutout of the season till a few days after Kennedy's assassination. He goes on to pitch 13 shutouts, 28 complete games, an earned run average of 1.12. I don't think we're ever going to see that again. That's amazing. And so he found this way to channel all this anguish and do very, very well out on the playing field.
Explain to me in more depth what it means. You write that he pitched better angry. How do you do that? What does that mean to you physically, or what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about those horrendous events and you're just, I'm going to get somebody for this, and you pitch better, or what does that mean?
I think in the case of Gibson, he was just able to channel somehow this anger, this uncertainty, and at least for those periods of time out on the mound. And games were a lot shorter then, in part because Bob Gibson was pitching and he worked so fast. I think he was able to just kind of channel those into these momentary rushes. I compare in the summer of 68 that to watch old footage of Bob Gibson that year is almost to look at a person so driven that he looks like a man on fire, so to speak. I mean, you know, you watch a game these days and the pitcher will spend, oh, my goodness, you know, 30 seconds, 45 seconds between pitches. You know, they'll rub the ball and walk around and do all this stuff. And when Gibson was on, and I talked to his catcher, Tim McCarver, about it at length, in essence, he was spending 10 seconds, 12 seconds between pitches. That's how channeled in he was. And McCarver even said as soon as he caught the ball, he knew he had to throw it back very quickly, put the signal down for the next, you know, for whatever the next pitch was going to be, fastball, curveball, and go and be ready, because that's how dialed in Gibson was. And I think, you know, there's a great many people sad or torn by what was going on. Here you have an individual on one of the biggest stages, at least in sports, so, you know, tens of thousands of people watching him every time he takes the mound. And he was able to take this anguish in the nation and just, you know, in a sense, make it work for him in this very specific way.
Did he talk as well, or did he just play baseball?
He pretty much just played baseball. In fact, there's a scene in Summer of 68 where, in a sense, Gibson's year and the Cardinals' year builds up to the Game 1 of the World Series, where Gibson strikes out a record 17 Tigers hitters, ends up striking out 17. And that broke Sandy Koufax's record, which has been set only a few seasons before. And when he tied Koufax's record in that game, the crowd rose. This is in St. Louis in Game 1. Rose is one, pretty much, applauding, standing ovation. The people in the crowd included Frank Sinatra, Julie Nixon, the daughter of Richard Nixon. Everybody's going crazy over this. Gibson is not paying any attention to it. And, in fact, it takes McCarver coming out from behind the plate instead of throwing the ball back to Gibson after they'd struck out the Tiger hitter that ties the record. McCarver comes out behind the plate, and he's yelling out to Gibson, "You've done it. You tied it." And Gibson has no idea what he's talking about.
Oh.
And, in fact, Gibson's response is, "Get back behind the plate. I need the pitch." And finally, McCarver breaks through to him, and Gibson just briefly, very briefly, looks around him at all these people applauding and just kind of very quickly acknowledges it, and then he tells McCarver, "Okay, get back behind the plate. It's time to play."
Wow. Have you written a book about Gibson?
No, I have not written one about Gibson.
And, that would be interesting.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy, and people kind of forget, he did coach in the major leagues for a while, and Joe Torre had him as a manager in New York, brought him in as one of his coaches, and they have very, pedestrian names, I guess. Baseball coaches do, like bench coach and bullpen coach and hitting coach. And when Torre brought Gibson in for a short while with the Mets, he said, "I think we're going to make Bob Gibson our attitude coach."
You start the book, he's another interesting player. There are so many featured in the book, with Willie Horton, who's trying his darndest to get an autograph.
Yes, from Bob Gibson.
Right,
of all people.
Exactly.
And it is turned down in a very unceremonious way. He actually takes the bus this is during spring training. This is just before King's assassination, and takes a bus up and kind of waits there with the other opposing team members to try to get an autograph from Gibson. And Gibson comes out and eyes the folks waiting for his autograph, maybe signs a couple, and then he sees Horton, who, is a very big man, and he just goes, "What position do you play?" And Horton goes, "Oh, I play outfield. I'm a hitter." And Gibson just goes, "No, I'm not. I don't sign for opposing hitters." And in a sense, he didn't even want to let down his guard in that sense. And, and Horton goes on to be probably with Gibson and Denny McClain and some of these other guys, one of the major characters in the summer of 68. And yet he coped in a totally different way. I mean, if anything, Willie Horton went about his life in 68, in essence, trying to make more friends, trying to develop his community. He told me something early on in one of the interviews, and I asked pretty much all these guys, "How did you cope?" Because that's how traumatic 68 was. Nobody was safe. I mean, you couldn't insulate yourself from what was going on around you. And when I asked Horton, "How did you cope?" He said something very curious. It didn't make sense at first. He said, "I kind of learned never to go that far away from home."
Hmm.
And you go, well, hang on a minute. You're a baseball player. You're traveling all over. I mean, you have to even go out to the West Coast. They had a team in Southern California with the Angels. And he just kind of smiled, and he goes, "Here's what I did." And he made good enough friends in every city that they went to traveling to play baseball, good enough friends that he could, if he wanted, go to their house for dinner, in essence, break bread with them. Even if he felt like it, may spend the night sleeping on their couch as opposed to going back to the team hotel. And as he told me, he said, "What I tried very specifically to do, and I worked, was wherever I went, I was not that far away from home. In a sense, he made home everywhere.
Oh my, that'll stay with me a long time. You also write that he, the year before, in 67, had risked his life trying to stop the riots in Detroit.
Yeah, he was, Horton was born in southwestern Virginia, but he came to Detroit at a young age and was pretty much considered a native son of Detroit. He grew up in the projects, and that's where Detroit the year before, that's where the riots took place. That's where the city started to burn. And I think people need to remember that a lot of U.S. cities unfortunately burned in 68, but Detroit unfortunately was kind of ahead of the curve. A lot of the riots and the burnings that happened elsewhere in 68, they started, you know, at least for the Detroit area, the year before. And when, and I need to set the stage a little bit, when the riots started midsummer in Detroit, the Tigers were playing a doubleheader. They were playing an afternoon game, then an evening game. And they were playing in the old Tiger Stadium, which was very built up with kind of pavilions on all sides. So there was no place where you can necessarily look out and see the city. And the only way the players and even the fans there knew something awful was going on was suddenly the sky to the north became completely smoke. It was just filled with smoke. And then word got around what was going on. Hey, riots have broken out on 12th and Claremont, et cetera. And as soon as Horton heard that, you know, his reaction was, that's where I grew up. I need to see what's going on. And so when the final game ends, Horton races into the Tigers clubhouse, pretty much just takes off his spikes and puts on another pair of shoes and heads to the riots. He's still in uniform. He's still wearing his Tiger uniform.
Oh my.
And he ends up climbing on top of a cab and telling people, please, you know, stop, go home. And unfortunately, his warning, you know, really wasn't heeded. In fact, several people said, Willie, we love you, but you got to get out of here or you're going to get hurt. And and reluctantly, he left. And in another twist, one of Horton's teammates, Mickey Lolich, pitched the first game, the afternoon game of that doubleheader that day in Detroit. And by that evening, as Horton is running off to try to single-handedly stop the riots, Lolich, a pitcher, has to immediately change from his uniform, his Tiger uniform, into his National Guard fatigues. By 10:30 that night, Mickey Lolich is part of the National Guard that's patrolling downtown Detroit trying to quell the riots. And so everybody, there's a connection here often, and I think sometimes, if anything, athletes today maybe have become too isolated, maybe too rich. And
they're pretty rich. There's no doubt about that. Tell me, how many other baseball players were members of the National Guard?
It really depended team to team, but it wasn't that unusual for, you know, each team to have maybe two, three, four individuals. And it was different for almost everybody, depending on the National Guard obligations. In the case of Lolich had, in essence, a pretty dismal regular season in 68. He goes on to become the World Series hero for Detroit, in part because he was stationed up in Alpena, Michigan, which was, you know, good 200 miles north, and he had nobody really to work out with. He told me this hilarious story about trying to play catch and throw to a priest, and he kept, like, beaning the priest on, like, the chest and the shins, and finally, he's going, oh man, I'm just, this isn't good. You know, I'm gonna end up in some bad place because look at what I'm doing to this priest. And it was different with everybody. Nolan Ryan, who goes on to become one of the preeminent pitchers of all time, in 1968, he's with the New York Mets, and he's having to go back on a pretty regular basis to Houston, Texas, where his National Guard unit was based, and it just created havoc with his training. I always find it interesting when you look back at old publications from various times, and everybody, you know, Sports Illustrated, Sport Magazine did these, you know, they always do, they still do them, like the season previews, And I was looking at the one for 68, and it occurred to me at one point, Kathleen, I'm going, well, what they should have had was another category. How many players on this roster are impacted by National Guard obligations? Because
right.
that's going to have a major
yes.
impact on how well this team does.
We're talking this hour with the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. We will during, I'm trying to figure out when to play this, we'll do it in about 10 minutes for those of you who want to hear Bobby Kennedy's speech before people in Central City, Indianapolis, the beautiful speech. And Tim reminds us of Dr. Martin Luther King's speech. I've been to the mountaintop, the speech that he gave the day before he died. That was yesterday, 44 years ago. Today, Kennedy's speech, 44 years ago. And we'll play that after we take a few phone calls and move into how Major League Baseball responded to the death of Bobby Kennedy and how players responded to that as well. Oh, it's bringing back a hard summer, huh? Tim Wendell is our guest, author of Summer of 68. Our phone number, let's go to a few phone calls momentarily, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to some phone calls. Jerry in Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, good morning. At that time, I was in the Marine Corps stationed in Vietnam, and for me, 1968 began with the Tet Offensive, and I was wondering if that made it into your book.
Yeah, Jerry, it did, and somewhat, in large part, with you know, the connection we were just talking about a little bit ago with the National Guard. Things were ratcheting up big time, and so, in a sense, even, you know, I mentioned Nolan Ryan. This was a period of time where Ryan, for several months during the 68 season, was convinced that his National Guard unit was potentially going to have to ship out and become much more involved with the war effort than it had been. He was part of a unit that kind of, engineering unit that built various structures and things. He didn't end up going over, you know, at the end, but that was, in a sense, the backdrop that not only were guys like Lolich and, you know, Ryan and multitude of other individuals that were happened to be playing sports too, had National Guard commitments, they were pretty much convinced that 68 went on, in large part because of the Tet Offensive and what was going on with the Vietnam War, that, in a sense, more and more of their time and more of their attention was going to have to be focused on this. It wasn't necessarily the case with a lot of individuals, but that was certainly playing a huge backdrop as that year started to unfold.
Baseball in 2012 and in recent memory has been very closely aligned with support our troops, with tributes to veterans, etc. How did baseball deal with this incredibly divisive war in 1968?
Oh, not that well. But, you know, in essence, you know, they were like any other institution trying to wrap their mind around it to a certain extent. I think what you saw was some real, maybe, epiphanies on an individual basis. And I think maybe one of them that comes to mind is a gentleman, Larry Durker, who went on to become the manager for the Houston Astros. In 1968, Larry was barely 22. He was just about ready to turn 22. But he was in the starting rotation as a pitcher for the Houston Astros. And Larry told me about, in a sense, how, in a, you know, he felt kind of safe in some ways because he was playing baseball, his military, you know, commitments were somewhat satisfied at the time. And yet, just having that whole part of him almost get cracked open when, ironically, the Astros are the team that's in Chicago scheduled to play the Cubs in late August when all the riots occur, you know, surrounding the Democratic Convention, which, you know, obviously a lot were anti-war based. And Larry, in the book, talks about how that was a real, maybe almost turning point for his whole life. You know, looking out of his window at the Conrad Hilton Hotel, looking down on Grant Park, et cetera, and seeing, in a sense, his peers, people his age, you know, being dealt with in such severe ways. And in a lot, a lot of ways. It's like, I've got to wake up. I need to know more of what's going on around me. And anybody knows Larry Durker today, that's certainly what he is.
Jerry, was 68 a turning point for you? Are you there, Jerry? He's not there anymore. I would imagine it was.
Yeah, I would think so.
Being in Vietnam in 68. Boyd is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guest. I was not around during the time of the summer of 68. I didn't come around until a few years later. But looking at some of the baseball history, and you did bring up Lolich and what have you, you may have touched on this, was Game 7 of the World Series, which was the pitching duel between Gibson and Lolich, for a lot of people watching it, was there more riding on the line than just maybe a world championship? It seems from hearing this whole scenario being played out, you know, it's almost like maybe the world championship was almost secondary. It's almost like there was just a lot of more personal emotions being invested in. Would you feel that was the case?
Yeah, I do, Boyd, and on a couple of different levels. I think if you look at, say, from the point of view of the Cardinals, who had a 3-1 lead in the 1968 World Series, figured that even when it got tied up and went to a Game 7, they were still in really good shape because they had their ace, Bob Gibson, coming back. And then to somehow improbably lose that was a shock to them. And I think in a lot of ways, if they win that World Series, and arguably you can make the case they should have, I think they would be considered one of the dynasty teams, certainly of that era. And I think in some ways they should still get consideration. They had won in 64. They had won in 67. They were looking to repeat in 68. And ironically now, I think, and maybe undeservedly so, they're a little bit more of an afterthought. And I know in talking to some of the Cardinal players from that team, they look upon that as an opportunity lost. I think the other backstory, and you bring up Lolich, is you talk about redemption. My goodness, I mean, here's a guy that went from being, you know, tied up with National Guard obligations, pitching to a priest, banished to the bullpen, and it wasn't even the starting rotation with the Tigers till later in the season, and is known as somewhat, you know, kind of a out of shape, you know, he had a beer belly, all this stuff, and yet he's the one who not only beats Gibson in Game 7, but in essence, is the last pitcher to win 3 complete games in the World Series. And it's almost kind of heartening because throughout the whole summer of 68, you know, almost kind of compare it to some kind of sibling rivalry or something. Denny McClain is getting all the acclaim with Detroit. You know, it's all these other players that are getting noticed both on his ball club and elsewhere. And yet, at the end, it's kind of the forgotten guy, the little brother, who kind of rises up in the case of Mickey Lolich, who saves the day for Detroit.
Mm. I know that we were at a turning point, and you write about this in the book, America still embracing baseball as its national sport, but the tide is turning and football becomes America's sport. Heaven forbid that should have ever happened in America, for heaven's sake. Did the turmoil of 68 have anything to do with that, that we liked rougher things because we'd been through so much violence?
Perhaps. I think the other thing that you know, violence was going up, and also things, in my mind, were getting more fragmented, and it seemed like the only way you could really maybe focus on something was just taken in small pieces. And if you look at a football game, that's really what a football game is. It's a bunch of small pieces that maybe add up to a final result or a final score. And it's funny, though, Kathleen, because I don't think certainly the powers that be in football didn't realize how, in a sense, popular their game was becoming. I mean, Nielsen ratings, all this weren't as advanced as certainly as they are now. And it took a very strange turn of events, the Heidi game, kind of right about the time the World Series is getting ready to start in fall of 08, where, just to review real quick, it was a game between the Jets and the Raiders on NBC. The Jets had Joe Namath, who's going to go on and win the world championship in a matter of months later. The Oakland Raiders were coached by John Madden. Yep, the guy who now does all the pitches and everything and, you know, used to be on the air with Monday Night Football, et cetera. And they played, and right at 7 o'clock, the game was still going on. The Jets were ahead, and NBC cut away. They cut away to show a made-for-TV movie called Heidi, which starred Julie Andrews' stepdaughter, of all things. And that's what the contract said. At 7 o'clock on the dot, we need to cut away. That's
imagine that.
And the Raiders score and probably score two touchdowns in 90 seconds and win the game. And now this is well before the Internet and well before we could get word around. So most of the country thought the Jets had won. And then when people started to hear, no, the Raiders came back and scored these two touchdowns and won the game, the switchboard at 30 Rockefeller Center at NBC almost melted down. Same with the New York Times. And suddenly, in essence, the powers that be in football went, oh, maybe we're more popular than we think we are. And ironically, today, if you're ever gnashing your teeth and, you know, whatever game you're watching, football game on a Sunday, is gone past now the top of the hour, and you'll start seeing them playing the little promos. Hang on, 60 minutes or whatever is coming. That's all a result of the Heidi game.
Oh, fascinating.
Because they were never going to do that again.
Thank you for that history. That's great. Tim Wendel is our guest this hour. His book is Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball in America forever. It weaves baseball and what was going on with the winning teams and players from many of the teams. This was also the time where he played the other teams in your league, and then you went on to the World Series. You didn't have as complicated a system as we have now. It also looks at the players playing in a time of violence and assassinations and war, and of course that had an impact on them as individuals and on teams as well. I think of all the sports, my husband is a baseball writer, people who write for baseball tend to be people who talk a lot of politics and look at the significance of how events influence sports and vice versa. So we're going to continue taking more phone calls. Boyd, as always, nice to hear from you. It was also, this is a significant day in American history, as was yesterday, as is every day, but we have yet to talk about how baseball responded to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, which took place just a few weeks after Martin Luther King's assassination, which happened 44 years ago today. And so I couldn't let this hour go by without playing. We've played this before, but if you never had a chance to hear how Bobby Kennedy walked, as Tim says, unscripted into Central City, Indianapolis, and broke the news of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and kept that city from becoming violent because he quoted Aeschylus. At the risk of being reduced to tears for the rest of this hour, I want to play this for you, and then we'll talk about how baseball responded to the Kennedy assassination. So we'll do that in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. And it was this day that changed America forever. Martin Luther King was assassinated on this day. And Bobby Kennedy broke the news to people gathered in Central City, Indianapolis. And this is what he said.
I have some very sad news for all of you. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible. You can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own day despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Forty-four years ago today, Bobby Kennedy, in Indianapolis, after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And then he was assassinated, and that just about did us in, Jim.
Yep, it certainly did. When I hear that again, Kathleen, and I listen to that a lot when I was writing Summer of 68, it kind of became one of the, you know, touchstones or whatever. But one of the things I find remarkable, and we alluded to this at maybe, you know, top of the hour, he is not reading from anything. I mean, that's, you know, all, you know, coming pretty much from the heart, off the top of his head. And even when he's quoting Aeschylus, you know, there toward the end, he knew that by heart. And that's one of the things I find, you know, just very remarkable about that time. And from what I was told from people in Kennedy's camp on that day, they had scribbled up some notes and such, and they handed it to him as he was about ready to go speak, and he's pretty much talking from their microphone from the back of a pickup truck, really. I mean, that was pretty much the stage. And he didn't even look at the notes. He simply kind of folded them up, and if you see footage of it, you can see him still having them in one hand, but it's not like he's desperate to see what his people are telling him to say. You know, he knew what to say.
He knew what to say. And he knew exactly how to say it. The response from Major League Baseball and from some of the players is a fascinating part of your book. When Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, there were some players who just didn't have it in them to play baseball.
Right, and I think they were maybe the most honest of the bunch. One was Maury Wills, the famous baseball leader in stolen bases for many years. He actually took one of Kennedy's books and retreated to the training room. He was in Pittsburgh at that point and pretty much told his coaches, his manager, "I'm not playing today. You know, you can find me, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to read this, and I'm just going to, in a sense, hunker down. Roberto Clemente did not want to play, but he was talked into playing by his manager. Some teams, it was a very dysfunctional way that baseball reacted to it. Pretty much teams in New York, Washington were told, you're not playing your games. Elsewhere, it was pretty much left up to the teams and the players. You had some situations, like in Cincinnati, where the team voted several times and it kept being a tie, you know, whether they're going to play or not. And then finally one player ended up saying, okay, we might as well play, and they went out, and that caused real division within that baseball team. In fact, a number of players were traded soon after that because of the protests they put up. I think one of the most heartening ones that I can remember is that the New York Mets were out, supposed to be playing out in San Francisco, playing the Giants that day. And it was bat day, which means it's a huge crowd, like 40,000 plus at the old Candlestick Park. And Gil Hodges, the manager, went around to the players at the hotel and pretty much just said, we're not going to play. I don't even want you to go out to the ballpark. Don't even go to Candlestick. You stay in your rooms. You stay out of sight. And I will take the heat on whatever happens. Ironically, Gil Hodges just died a couple days ago. And the Giants were very upset. I mean, in a sense, they were going to lose, in a sense, what was a potential, you know, real walk-up gate, a lot of money. But the Mets stuck to their guns. They did not play that day. And in essence, one of the things I found interesting later on, about a week later, Gil Hodges gets a telegram from, in a sense, Frank Moskowitz and some of the other folks that were part of Kennedy's campaign. Another one, Jeff Greenfield, is now with CBS News. And pretty much was a note saying, thank you, you know, for not playing on that day.
And there's such a, considering the fact that Kennedy had mentioned him, as you mentioned earlier, right before he was assassinated, Drysdale, there's a picture of Drysdale in the book with a black armband around him.
Yep.
It says so much, that picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Dodgers wore black armbands, and I know in, you know, we've alluded to this, but in Kennedy's last speech at the Ambassador Hotel, you know, roughly 2 months later, you know, the first line he says is pretty much, I would like to thank Don Drysdale tonight for pitching either its fifth or sixth shutout. And I think maybe we get too jaded after a while. I know when I first saw the transcript for that speech, I went, oh, well, maybe he's doing like most politicians. I mean, he's kind of speaking to whatever the buzz is in town. And it wasn't until later that, in doing some research for Summer 68, that I realized how many prominent athletes from that time, in a sense, were backing Kennedy's campaign. Bill Russell, the player coach for the Boston Celtics basketball team, Oscar Robertson, Donald Dell, the tennis player, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, the sports and politics was so intertwined at that point that when Vince Lombardi stepped down as coach of the Green Bay Packers, one of the first notes he receives is from Bobby Kennedy. And some of this is tongue-in-cheek, but some of it was a little bit serious, because Lombardi was, in a sense, his name was bandied about at one point at the Democratic National Convention as a VP candidate. And what Kennedy wrote to Lombardi was, you know, sorry to hear you've stepped down, coach. Now how about joining my team?
Well, sports and politics were very much a part of the Kennedy family, too, right?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Certainly, you know, the touch football games and such.
Right.
You know, and I think that sometimes, too. I think sometimes we divide up these worlds and say, well, you know, they don't connect. But certainly in 68, they connected. You know, somebody like Dr. King passing Bob Gibson in an airport and knowing immediately who that young man was. You know, there was a lot of overlap between these worlds.
Yeah, there sure was. Well, I'll never get, I know eventually today I'll need to move beyond 1968, but boy, am I ever steeped in this day right now. Ooh, my.
Yeah, it's one of those days where it kind of comes back around. But I think one of the things, it's actually, Kathleen, several of the athletes reminded me of this, you know, that I was interviewing. You know, they were adamant in some ways that, yeah, things were really, really tough and the country was falling apart and all this. But almost to a person, the next thing they would kind of end with would be, but we got through it. Mm-hmm. We hung together. And if anything, I think that's maybe, you know, the real message of 68. Things are really tough, but we got through it.
Mm-hmm. We were all in it together, no matter where we were politically, and we were all over the place, but we will always remember of it, those of us who lived, and now more people know about it thanks to your writing. Tim, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
Oh, no, great to be on your show, Kathleen. Thanks for inviting me on.
Tim Wendel, the book is Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball in America forever. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for being the producer of this program, and thanks to Rhonda as well for doing all the on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow, same time. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.